Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony returns to the Chapin Music Hall stage tomorrow evening with a program titled Strauss and Schumann, featuring soprano Sarah Coburn as soloist, with principal guest conductor Daniel Heggie, who joins me today as my guest. Coburn will sing the elegiac four last songs of Richard Strauss. These are settings done near the end of the composer's life, featuring poetry by Hermann Hesse and Joseph von Eichendorff, all which approach death with a sense of calm, completeness, and mystery. It's beautiful music indeed. Also in the program will be Edward Elgar's orchestration of Bach's Fantasia and Fugue in C minor, which merges late Romanticism with Bach's Baroque counterpoint, and Robert Schumann's Symphony No. 2 in C. Heggie, who is also the music director of the Wichita Symphony and the Binghamton Philharmonic, joins us today to preview tomorrow night's concert. Daniel Heggie, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us, and Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year to you too, Rich.
And it's a really interesting show that you start the new year. It's a show of German music, basically.
It really is. I mean, Elgar, of course, starts the program, but it's a transcription of Bach, so we're back to German at its roots.
And this piece is really interesting. There's a number of transcriptions of Bach's organ works, the Fantasia and Fugue in C minor. This one seems a little different than I think most of the transcriptions we're used to hearing. And most people hear Stokowski, which is really in your face.
Yes, very overt with
and
everything.
Bombastic,
yeah, extremely bombastic. And, you think of the Toccata Fugue, and that was made famous on Fantasia. Elgar's, in comparison, is more understated. It has a very beautiful English poise to it. So you hear, even though all the notes are Bach's and the structure, you really hear a lot of Elgar's personality in the way he orchestrates it. It just sounds like Elgar, even though it's Bach's music. And it's great to relish in those textures. You're not really thinking about performance practice, as it were, if you were actually doing a transcription with kind of the bare-bones Baroque-sized orchestra. You're not thinking about those because Elgar's lines need to be sustained in a way that you wouldn't do that in Baroque music.
Yeah, and also the Fantasia really sounds like it was written in the early 20th century.
Right, it does.
I mean, all the melodic material does have that, goes back to the Baroque era, but the way it's orchestrated, the way it's put together, it really sounds like a piece of the 20th century.
It really does, because it has so many layers to it. And of course, you're hearing prominent horns and things like that throughout. So you're not really reminded that it's really from the 18th century. And like I said, Elgar really puts his stamp on it, on both the Fantasia and the Fugue section, which are almost like two separate pieces under the same umbrella.
Yeah, it really is, because the Fugue does have that Baroque sense.
Yeah,
and
it does.
Shares a lot more similarities with other transcriptions of Bach organ works.
It does. It really has the sense of the fugal writing sounds like Bach. And so it's unmistakably Bach. It has that Baroque sense of counterpoint. Now, people like Beethoven and Mozart, they all use counterpoint too, but in a different way. This harkens back more to the Bach style because it is Bach. But because of how Elgar fortifies the lines and combines them with different instruments in the orchestra, it has genuinely a very kind of romantic, post-romantic feel to it.
Mm-hmm. That texture you're talking about, can you maybe describe how that sounds as opposed to, your traditional transcription of a Bach fugue?
Yeah. So for example, he'll be doubling certain instruments, like the horns will be with the violas or the cellos. So you can really hear that sonority is a blend of several different things at once. And even when he starts the beginning of the fugue, he'll have many instruments in the orchestra starting on just the first two notes. Da-yum! And then they fade out, and then other people continue on with the rest of the subject. And then other people are joining in for just several notes, and then they back away again. So it isn't just one voice that's doing it, or even just a combination of instruments that are playing the subject the whole time. Other instruments jump in, and they jump out again. And so you have this real collage of color, orchestra color, that he's working with.
It's funny, when you think of comparing that to, say, another English composer who's taking Baroque music and, Britten, who uses Purcell, mm-hmm. He's sort of showcasing each section of the orchestra in turn.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you're listening to this blend and melding of a line that's the various instruments are coming in and out.
Yeah. And of course, Elgar makes quite a lot of boisterous outbursts that sound just like Elgarian kind of things like you would hear in Enigma variations or in the symphonies, where suddenly a lot of instruments just for color will be playing very fast and extremely melismatic kind of passages, and then they just back out again. And he uses the brass to full force as well. So by the end, I mean, it's just this overpowering sound, a little bit Stokowski-esque, actually, towards the very end.
True. But contrast that with the beginning of the piece. It's very different. And I'd like to hear I'd like folks to hear the beginning of this piece, because it does give you a sense of how the Fantasia and the Fugue are almost like a work, but two different works at the same time.
Yes.
And there's an interesting story about that, isn't there?
Well, yeah. And it's interesting that coincidentally, we have Richard Strauss on this program, having written the four last songs that will follow this work. Elgar and Strauss struck up a bit of a friendship. I mean, they met in 1920, and this was after the First World War, of course, and they talked about writing this piece, transcribing this Bach work, and that Richard Strauss would write the Fantasia section and Elgar would write the Fugue section. And Elgar sat down right away and he wrote out the Fugue, and he was waiting and waiting and waiting for Strauss to write the Fantasia part, and it just never came to pass. Apparently, Strauss didn't hold up his end of the bargain. We don't know exactly why. But then Elgar decided to go ahead and orchestrate and transcribe the Fantasia section also. So now the entire piece is Fantasia and Fugue transcribed and orchestrated by Edward Elgar. And that was around 1921. And then it was performed in 1922 and to great success.
Well, let's hear the beginning of this opening. And of course, it does sound like, do you approach it as late Romantic music, or do you sort of try to get a combination of the two ways you would approach a piece like this?
In this particular case, I'm leaning much more towards Elgar in terms of the style of how we do it, because he was very expressive with his markings, how he wanted it to sound. And like I was mentioning before, if this had been a transcription that was supposed to be just very much in the Baroque style, we would be, for example, diminuendoing off of certain notes so that other voices could come through. He writes it so that you can actually hear all those parts in the way that he's written little crescendos and diminuendos and swells and things like that. So if you really go for the Elgar aesthetic, the music should speak properly.
All right. Well, let's hear a little bit of this. The beginning of the Fantasia and Fugue in C minor by Bach, as orchestrated by Edward Elgar.
Great.
That's music which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday night in a program titled Strauss and Schumann, but there's also some Bach as arranged and orchestrated by Elgar as well in the concert, which takes place this Saturday evening at 7:30. And as you were mentioning, Daniel, Strauss was supposed to write the Fantasia, but we're going to hear Strauss next on the program with these utterly luscious four last songs.
Some of the most sublime writing in all of music, not just in all of Strauss's output, but in all of music, I think.
You know, the four last songs, I'm a trombone player, and I don't have much to do on the four last songs, but it is a joy to sit in the orchestra and just listen. And of course, they're great to listen to as well in an audience.
Yes.
Is it that sort of feeling as a conductor?
As a conductor, I have to really be thinking about managing everything properly. So I got to know these songs when I was much younger, and I got to listen to them a lot. And then I got to study the score for them to see how they're really constructed. So I'm always thinking as a conductor up there that I have a great responsibility more than anything else. So while there is time to, I guess, bask in that sound and really enjoy it, which I will, I still have to be thinking about, is the singer, does she have enough breath right here? Are we covering too much? Are we bringing out this voice enough? it's always thinking about how the art is happening at that moment. So there's a big responsibility in addition to having the deep emotional involvement.
Because these are so beautiful and luscious, is it possible to love it too much? You know what I'm saying? You know, where you just sort of
letting, you get carried away
and basking, and you sort of lose the energy and the right. forward motion of
it. It's very important anytime, I think, for any musician, that while they're fully invested emotionally, they have to be fully engaged with their mind about what's actually happening, because it is possible that you would lose the line. You have to have gone through. I mean, basically, the way I approach any of the music is that I go through and I study it extremely carefully about how it has to work in terms of tempo and line and the certain points of climax and where we go away from it and so on. And then when you get into the rehearsal process, that deepens, that sense of the analysis of the score deepens. And when you get to the performance, you basically can let go now. You can really, you feel like the work has been done, and you can allow yourself to really be in the moment emotionally. But that can only really happen the best, I think, if you've studied it carefully and rehearsed it carefully. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
Of course, Sarah Coburn will be the soloist. This is one of those pieces that if you were just thinking superficially, you say, well, why would a soprano love to sing this? Because, you know, it doesn't have pyrotechnics. It doesn't show off her range. But it is just pure melody.
It is pure melody.
And the emotion being conveyed is so important, too.
Exactly. I mean, the soprano in this case is the protagonist for the work, and she's delivering these wonderful poems, three of them written by Hermann Hesse, the other one by Josef von Eichendorff. And to deliver that text with these soaring lines and this very magisterial at times orchestration, I think would just be something to relish for any singer. So I'm looking forward to working with Sarah on bringing these pieces of music to life.
Now, is it different working with a singer than with an instrumentalist, a soloist?
Sometimes. I mean, certainly because she's conveying text, that is paramount, that get across, as opposed to, let's say, a violinist or a pianist. They're not using text as any vehicle. They're only using the notes. And, of course, you have to hear the nuances. And if there's too much orchestra accompaniment, that can obviously obscure some of the details. Even though you might be able to hear the sound okay, you're not hearing all of the details. And so it's very important to pave the way for that to happen. We get very spoiled with recordings because so much can be manipulated in the recording booth. They can turn down certain things. You can hear sometimes, let's say, a trombone is playing with a fortissimo, super loud kind of sonority, and yet you can still hear every voice. You can even hear the violas in there. And that's just not realistic. You have to, in a live situation, in a hall, you have to change the dynamic sometimes in the color so that you can really hear the voices that should be most prominent. And of course, in this case, it's the voice. And her color is going to be and should be the most prominent. Although Strauss does write at times for the orchestra to almost overwhelm the voice at times. And I think that's by design that he wants that to happen. But for the most part, we should be able to hear the voice. And that's something that I'm always thinking about, is balance and line and details being heard exquisitely.
And this poetry is so beautiful. I mean, the four last songs are talking, you know, September. It's a metaphor of coming to the end.
Yes, coming to the end of one's life.
Yeah.
Well, you know, basically with all of these four songs, the different titles, one is called Spring, which we don't associate with something that's coming towards the end. But the way spring begins is out of a slumber, and you feel this. And it's almost like it's appreciation for life. It's almost like Strauss is looking back on life and appreciating it, and they have that spring. September, of course, the autumnal quality of that is like preparing for what's going to come. On Going to Sleep is another one. It's called Beim Schlafgehen. And then, of course, the last one, Im Abendrot, is like the twilight. So the twilight. So there's a real theme going on here. But, you know, the real sense of these songs is something of completeness and kind of being at peace with everything and seeing death as just another step in life. There's nothing that's morose or dark. Sometimes there's a mystical quality to the music, but there's a feeling of acceptance and a feeling of I'm ready for this next step. And it's very beautiful in that way. There's no false hope or anything like that, but it just feels like there's this grandeur of looking back on life and accepting it with a smile and saying, I'm a bit tired now. And then there's that beautiful moment in the last song of the four last songs, Im Abendrot. This is the poetry of Josef von Eichendorff, where the music is pausing and the singer sings, "Is this perchance? We wait. Death." And the sound of the orchestra even has an interrogative feel to it. And then it just kind of marches on to this beautiful conclusion, ending in major, B-flat major. Yeah. It's not dark at all. It's very beautiful. And there's so much poise and peace in these songs.
That idea, that interrogative you're talking about, that question mark, it is really amazing that Strauss can make an orchestra put a question mark into this piece.
You know, Strauss always was, I mean, he wasn't always bragging about this necessarily, but he knew that he was good at that. There's one time apparently he was writing an opera and he said, "Not only can I show you just through the notes that I compose that a man is drinking beer, I can tell you what brand it is." And he was very good at it, and he knew it. He knew he was good at it. And you have this feeling when you're studying Strauss that he was just such a facile composer, that he could just sit down and write, and he could write with this incredible range of emotions and just was able to do it. You don't feel like he was really going through a lot of tumult and how do I do this, that you feel with Mahler, for example. Sometimes you feel like he's really agonizing a way to express something. With Strauss, though, it feels like it's just almost effortless. It just flows, and it has an inevitability to how it rolls right off his pen and onto the paper, and then we get to play it.
My guest today is Daniel Heggie, the principal guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony, which will be performing the four last songs of Strauss with soprano Sarah Coburn, along with the Schumann Symphony No. 2 and a Bach Elgar transcription, Fantasia and Fugue in C minor, this Saturday evening at 7:30. Let's hear a little bit of the second movement of the four last songs. This is, to me, one of the most gorgeous points, where it's where the soprano sings and then the orchestra sort of comes back and does this towards the ends of September.
Right. And one thing I wanted to note, you know, mention, we were talking about how Strauss can create these kind of sounds. He's using the poetry, of course, as a vehicle for the expression, but he's able to tone paint or use the text so when you hear a certain word, you hear a certain sound in the orchestra that makes you think of it. We are going to have super titles up above the orchestra so the audience will be able to see what the text is, the translation, because Sarah will be singing in German, which is what it's written in. But they'll see the English translation while they're hearing the orchestra, and so I think that's going to be a real beautiful added effect.
All right, well, let's hear music from the four last songs of Richard Strauss. Music by Richard Strauss, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra with soprano Sarah Coburn. That was Jesse Norman, probably the best recording ever of that piece. My guest today is Daniel Heggie, the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, which will be leading the orchestra this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Well, after intermission, you come back with a typical, I think, romantic symphony in the Germanic tradition. This is Robert Schumann Symphony No. 2. Tell us a little bit about this piece.
Well, it's interesting that his Opus 60, which was the piece right before this piece, which is Opus 61, they were six organ preludes that were about Bach. They were orchestrated and written B-A-C-H, which are four of the letters that you can actually, on transliteration, you can play them on piano. B would be B-flat, A, C, and then H would be B-natural in the German transliteration system. And so there was a real preoccupation with Bach just to kind of tie this program together in terms of its musicality. We're bookending with these composers that are kind of paying homage to Bach. Because when we hear the beginning of the Second Symphony, we're hearing a kind of a chorale and this kind of very understated fanfare that's played in the trumpet and trombone and horn. And meanwhile, this very beautiful and lush undergirding of strings below it. And then the woodwinds come in and then it kind of metamorphoses into this beautiful allegro section, which is very agitated. Just to give a little bit of backdrop about Schumann at the time he was composing this, we know that Schumann had a lot of nervous breakdowns. He was mentally ill and had a real difficulty with this. And around 1844, he died in 1856. In 1844, he was experiencing some of his darkest days. And it was really very difficult for him. And he set out to compose the Second Symphony as kind of a healing process for himself, which I think is really fascinating that he could, for one thing, that he had this genius ability to write music, of course, but that he could give vent to his mental illness by composing it as a process to heal himself. And in a way, he feels like that it did work. And so it starts off in a fairly ambiguous way. It's not really dark, but it's not really positive. You're kind of somewhere in the middle, which may have been expressing his mental state at the time. And then it moves in this very agitated section in the first movement. We get to the end of that, and it's actually a sense of victory of sorts. And then we move to the second movement, and which is a very famous scherzo, notably for the first violins. It's on every excerpt list.
Yes,
to get
is.
Into any professional orchestra, a first violinist has to be able to play the scherzo all the way through. It's very, very difficult. It's like pyrotechnics. It's very fast. It's like a perpetual motion every time the scherzo section comes back. But I tell you, this orchestra is going to nail that. It's really like a showpiece.
It is.
It's like a showpiece for the orchestra to play the second movement of this symphony. And they're just doing fantastically well. There are two trio sections in that scherzo movement, and they are just sublime. They're just so richly textured and layered. I was going through that second trio again, looking at it, and it really bears the influence of Bach and Beethoven, the way he writes the counterpoint, the way the subject keeps coming back and forth. But the beauty is just in the textures themselves and the line and the melody. Then we get to the third movement, which is a slow movement, and it's the only movement that starts in C minor. So it's the only time where we actually experience, it's not darkness, but it's a bit of a melancholy quality. It's kind of like an elegy. And when you hear the first phrase, you think that's just the most gorgeous melody I've ever heard. It's like he plucked it out of somewhere out in the celestial world and brought it down to earth. That's what it really feels like to me. Like it's something that was already composed somewhere in some godly area, and he brought it to earth. But it starts in C minor, fairly somber feeling, and then it just kind of evolves and blooms and has all of these layers. And it's amazing how he can take something like that seems fairly simple at the beginning and make it very complex and interesting. And yet for the listener, a line to just hold on to all the way through. It's the endless variety he creates is astonishing. And it ends in major. So, you know, we've kind of gone from darkness to light just within the third movement. Then we get to the fourth movement. It's just gangbusters. It really feels like he's come out of the cloud completely, and it's just all forward. It has this propulsive quality that just keeps going and going and going. And it's just, I think, just unfettered joy.
And what was interesting, as you told us earlier, he was at a really emotionally fragile point when he started writing this. He wrote it almost as therapy for himself.
Yes.
And he writes the sketches, and then when he's orchestrating it, he has another episode.
Mm-hmm.
And they take him to a place to relax. He's finally able to relax and complete the symphony.
Right.
It's really it's the story behind the symphony, which, again, it has all this joy, all this romantic fervor that you expect to hear in a piece. And yet when you hear the backstory, it's just amazing he's able to complete it.
It is. In some ways, you know, when we talk about programmatic music, we talk about there being a story behind the music. And that's usually something that's based on literature that we know, like there's this book or this poem or this story. In this particular case, there isn't some other piece of literature that he's using. He's just using his own life. And so there is a real story behind it. And yet he wants it to be understood and enjoyed, I think, as just music that expresses the complexity of human emotions. I want to say it's my favorite Schumann symphony, but when I'm doing other Schumann symphonies, I do think those are my favorite. You know, whichever one I'm conducting at the moment is my favorite Schumann symphony. But I think Schumann has sometimes gotten a bad rap when it comes to orchestra music, because there's that kind of, I don't know, I want to say like dime store kind of adage about him being not such a great orchestrator.
Right.
That he wasn't great at it. But I think there should be no condemning him for that. If you look at the way he actually wrote the music, you look at it through his eyes, you can see what he's trying to say. And he creates a very special sound world. Anytime with any composer, a conductor has to be thinking about how do we get these lines to work the best so they can be most audible. They can be prominent when they're supposed to, and other lines be a little bit less. You're always working with those things. You have to work a little bit more with Schumann at times. But I think the way he orchestrates is actually quite brilliant.
We're going to hear a piece. What should we hear?
Oh, my. Well, you know, the scherzo is just all-out fun. And I think that would be a great one to hear. Is it the charming trios in it? But I love that third movement. The third movement of this symphony, in some ways, just the heart and the soul behind the whole symphony.
Let's hear a little bit of the third movement.
Okay,
here.
Good.
This will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, the Schumann Symphony No. 2. Here's the Adagio movement, the third movement. That's music from Robert Schumann, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday evening at 7:30. My guest today is Daniel Heggie, the principal guest conductor. And as we talk about this program overall, again, there's this very Germanic feel to it. It's sort of like a period piece in a lot of ways. I mean, you have this Bach, but it's late Romantic. You have Romantic that harkens back to Bach and the Schumann, and then you have this sheer beauty of the Strauss four last songs.
It's interesting because in all the songs, you could all tie this together as it has this feeling of, you know, there's a somber quality in C minor, and that's what we do the Bach Elgar in. But yet it has so much rejoicing in it as well. I mean, there's so much overt kind of outburst in the orchestra. And then you have the four last songs, which deal with the end of our lives, but it's looked at in a way that is very inevitable, complete, and in with full acceptance of it, with a really kind of a smile on one's face saying, I've lived a good life, and I'm ready to go to sleep now. And then you go to the Schumann, and you look at how the composer worked basically from darkness to light and use the music. So there's this kind of common thread that goes through the entire program, and I think it's one of the most beautiful programs I've ever seen and having the chance to conduct.
All right. Well, we look forward to the results this Saturday evening.
Great.
Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
Daniel Heggie is the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. He'll be leading the orchestra in a program titled Strauss and Schumann tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center with soprano Sarah Coburn as soloist. For information on the program and ticket information, visit tulsasymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. We're going to leave you with that audition piece from the Schumann Symphony that Daniel mentioned. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.